Up until the 16th century, the local beer was a complex blend of plants, herbs, and spices, its composition being a mystery for the common people and, in any event, a trade secret for the privileged manufacturer. Before being strictly limited to its three essential parts, barley, water, and hops, beer of the era was a highly intoxicating recipe. Narcotic, aphrodisiacal, and psychotropic when consumed in sufficient quantity. Some have used the word, quote, hallucinogenic. The Groot trade meant big money, and the Catholic Church enforced a veritable ecclesiastical monopoly on its taxable cash cow. It is probably no coincidence that the purity law came into being just before the German theologian Martin Luther was excommunicated by the Catholic Church in 1520, further inciting the Reformation. At its core, the Bavarian push for tax-free hops was a spiritual protest against the perceived greed and self-indulgence of the Vatican's clergy in their drugged beer. Eventually, the Bavarian revolt won the day, making the innocent hop, humulus lupulus, the only socially acceptable additive now servicing the global beer industry. But before that, perhaps as far back as the Stone Age, beer was a wild ride. I never tasted Mutterkorn, admits the scientist, but I know it's very, very dangerous, and you can get really crazy. We had a lot of problems with that in medieval times. Right, the ergot poisoning of St. Anthony's Fire. They called it the ignis sacer, the holy fire that caused the seizures and hallucinations. But these guys were professionals, continues Zarnkel, referring to the prehistoric brewers. And the ones who knew about medicines and such things could do a controlled contamination of Mutterkorn. So if we've had beers for feasting and beers for medicine, why not this special type of drink? I totally believe we've had beers like that before. He goes on to compare the ergot of a psychedelic kukian to modern-day koji, the Aspergillus oryzae fungus used in Japan to ferment soybeans and rice, producing soy sauce and the alcoholic sake. When properly monitored and harvested, the creative applications of fungi, antibiotics, and other microorganisms, humanity's first pets, are seemingly endless. Their symbiotic relationship with grain was already locked in place from the very beginning of the apparent beer revolution 13,000 years ago. Ever since the Anatolian funeral feast at the University of Pennsylvania in 2000, we have gained unprecedented insight into the extreme beverages of ancient Greece and the prehistoric reach of the graveyard beer that may have inspired the mysteries, or perhaps, Western civilization at large. We know for a chemical fact that a Greek brew was circulating around the ancient Aegean. Because of recent analyses at the Rockefet Cave and Göbekli Tepe, there is strong data to suggest that elixir had Stone Age roots, and I now have it on good authority from the world's preeminent beer scientist here in the heart of Bavaria that ancient brewmasters could very well have concocted a psychedelic potion spiked with ergot. But it's gotten us no closer to a definitive answer at Eleusis. If none of Kaiopis Papangeli's vessels at the archaeological site in Greece can be tested, we may never know the actual contents of the kukian. With the sky blackening and the rain unchanged from when I first arrived, Zarnkel kindly drops me off at the Freising train station. He directs me straight to Augustinerbrau, the oldest independent brewery in Munich, founded in 1328, where I've been instructed to try the Edelstoff lager. About an hour later, I'm plopped onto the wooden bar stool in the packed dining room, still shivering from the bitter cold. As I sip the golden hells from a fat German beer stein, one name keeps coming to my mind. Triptolemus. The royal demigod personally dispatched by the Lady of the Grain to civilize the Mediterranean. According to the hymn to Demeter, he was supposed to teach the art of agriculture to all humankind, but we know from the DNA and material evidence that farming had already spread across Europe thousands of years before the erection of Demeter's temple at Eleusis. People already knew how to tend the land, so what was his real job? The Eumolpids and Cercies, the hereditary officiants who controlled the mysteries and collected their clerical dues from the start, probably didn't like it, but Triptolemus took off on his flying dragon cart for what Ruck calls a proselytizing mission. For those pilgrims who could afford it, the journey to Eleusis could always happen over the 2,000 years of the site's activity. But for those who could not, there had to be alternatives. After the conquest of Alexander the Great, the Hellenic influence over the ancient world stretched from modern-day Spain in the west to Afghanistan in the east. Any Greek speaker would have been welcomed into the mysteries, but the distance for some was simply prohibitive. So maybe it wasn't the grain that was the focus of Triptolemus's roaming lesson, but what grows on the grain, and how the ergot and humanity's first pets could be manipulated through Zarnkal's, quote, controlled contamination to deliver a potion that promised immortality. If brewing really is the oldest biotechnology on the planet, and if potentially fatal hallucinogens were in the mix, then it would have taken highly trained specialists to pass that skill along. If the Kukion made it outside the sacred precinct in Eleusis, then hard archaeobotanical evidence of the ritual drink should have survived somewhere in the vast Greek-speaking world of the ancient Mediterranean. And if Wasson, Hoffman, and Ruck were right about ergot as the active ingredient, then there should be evidence of that too. Nothing less will settle the vicious debate about the best-kept secret in the history of Western civilization. For centuries, all the professionals on the relentless hunt for the Kukion have come up empty-handed, no stone left unturned. But if Heinrich Schliemann, Milman Perry, or Michael Ventris left any legacy with their brilliant, paradigm-changing discoveries, it's that the professionals aren't always looking in the right place or speaking the right language. No matter how advanced your ancient Greek, if something turns up at an archaeological site in a remote corner of the Mediterranean with a shunned, modern language, the professionals might never hear about it, nor the public for that matter. Sometimes, the evidence has to just sit there, waiting 20 years for somebody to take notice. Chapter 7. The Kukion of Catalonia. As I approached the Benedictine Abbey of Saint-Père de Galigon, I paused to enjoy the February sun breaching the cypress trees and reflecting off the bright limestone ashlars of the rectangular facade. Under a grand rosette, the church's main entrance features five archivolts that recess into the medieval darkness. Where they meet spiraling columns a few feet overhead, stone gargoyles beckon me into the chilly, damp interior. Here in Girona, an hour and a half up the Spanish coast from Barcelona, construction of this Romanesque building began in 1131. The local branch of the Archaeological Museum of Catalonia chose this picturesque landmark as its home in 1857. I would later learn that a scene from Game of Thrones was shot here, which makes perfect sense in retrospect. The whole monastery looks like something out of a fable, the perfect venue to come face to face with some very old secrets. It is excruciatingly difficult to track down hard, undisputed evidence of hallucinogenic beer in the Mediterranean during the life of the mysteries, circa 1500 BC to AD 392. But after years of searching and months of poring over a neglected monograph in the world's largest library back home in Washington, D.C., I'm finally closing in on the motherlode. Ever since my meeting with Martin Zarnkow in Germany, I've been emailing with Dr. Enriqueta Pons, the former head of this museum and longtime director of excavations at an archaeological site 30 minutes to the north called Mas Castellar de Pontos. From 450 to 400 BC, Greek colonists built the oldest structures on the ancient complex that rises above the Empordà plain on a grassy plateau, 17 kilometers from the coast of modern-day Empúries. The ancient Greeks called it Emporion, founded in 575 BC by pioneers from the Anatolian port city of Phocaia in Ionia, the western coast of modern-day Turkey. Experts in long-distance trade, these same Phocaians, the so-called Vikings of antiquity, first established Massalia, now Marseille in France, around 600 BC, and after Emporion, they would move on to Elia, now Velia, in southern Italy, around 530 BC. The Greek Vikings appear to have gotten along well with the indigenous Iberian community, the Indigetes, who liked the exotic goods that their new seafaring friends brought from the east. For their part, the Phocaeans won another important foothold in the ever-growing network of colonies here in the western Mediterranean. They were an intensely spiritual people. Not surprisingly, religion shows up in Emporion from the very beginning. In antiquity, the city was known for its temple dedicated to Artemis of Ephesus, which has yet to be excavated. A cult statue of Asclepius, the Greek god of healing and drugs, has survived from his ancient sanctuary. The Pentelic and Parian marble, which could only have been imported from the Greek homeland, stands proudly in the Archaeological Museum of Empúries. Several drachma, or Greek coins, have been recovered from the area as well. From the 3rd century BC, they show the head of Persephone. In 2008, a ceramic kernos was unearthed during ongoing excavations. It is a colonial variation of the very same vessels that were used to mix the kukion, now on display in the Archaeological Museum of Eleusis. The Empúries kernos has three cups topping a circular base and dates back to the 5th century BC. The curators believe the discovery of many such vessels in this region of Spain is intriguing evidence of an ancient mystery cult linked to Demeter and Persephone. At some point, elements of this Phocaean religion traveled inland to Mas Castellar de Pontos, where echoes of the Eleusinian mysteries intensify. Following the original Greek settlement in the 5th century BC, the indigenous Iberians added a fortified outpost in the early 4th century. Thereafter, what Pons calls a Hellenistic farmstead dominated the site under heavy Greek influence, flourishing from about 250 to 180 BC, when it was likely destroyed by the Romans. The three phases of occupation, Greek colonists, Iberian villagers, and Hellenistic farmers, are clear from Pons's systematic excavations that began in 1990. Over the past 30 years, she has unearthed a number of subterranean grain silos framing a densely urbanized housing complex that sits at the top of a large open field surrounded by woods. Though much of the 6-acre site remains unexplored, Pons's surveys indicate as many as 2,500 silos still underground. She concludes, the settlement acted as a place for the concentration, distribution, and trading of agricultural surpluses. Like the bustling import-export business over at Emporion, or the massive grain silo that Kaiopi Papangeli showed me on the archaeological site of Eleusis, 1,500 miles to the east, Mas Castellar de Pontos made a fitting home for the Lady of the Grain and her daughter, the Queen of the Dead. As a matter of fact, the links between the Greek farm and Eleusis are hard to avoid. In one of the excavated silos, numbered 101, Pons discovered the disembodied terracotta head of a female deity. The face is cocked slightly to the right, her hair pulled back in a bun. Deposited with her was an unguentarium, or oil container, which is elsewhere associated with graveyards. The vestiges of a fire pit were identified, with three different types of wood: silver fir, oak, and Scotch pine. Each of the species grew in the mountains, some distance from the archaeological site. Mixed in with the trees were the remains of olive, millet, and barley. Together with the ritual items, Pons found a treasure trove of artifacts, all dating to the 3rd century BC, including 9 Greco-Italic amphoras. The terracotta goddess and oil container appear to have been intentionally buried in the silo as an offering to the underworld, leading Pons to identify the head as Demeter or Persephone, sometimes called Kore. The archaeologist says the cave-like silo, once used to stockpile grain, had been converted into a sacred subterranean chamber. It is strangely reminiscent of the hollowed-out rock shelter below the Greek Orthodox Church overlooking the ruins of Eleusis, where Persephone was said to emerge from Hades during the reenactment of the mysteries. 2 related finds only further confirm the connection to Eleusis. In another silo, number 28, 5 ceramic thimiateria, or incense burners, were unearthed in 1979. One of them has been perfectly restored, showing the bust of a female deity. Dating to the 3rd century BC, the artifact shows a woman's face centered between fins on either side of the vessel, the top of which is a shallow basket for capturing incense. Pons identifies the goddess as Demeter, though Persephone cannot be ruled out. In addition, some relationship between Mas Castellar de Pontos and the mysteries seems all but certain from the discovery of a kalathos, or Greek storage vessel, at the nearby site of San Julia de Ramis, just north of Girona. Dating from 225 to 175 BC, The ceramic is cracked and damaged, but the iconographic relief projecting from its surface is well preserved. Under a handle on the right, a woman's head emerges from the side of the vessel. She too is likened to Demeter or Persephone, mainly because of the figure who straddles a flying dragon cart to her left. It's the same Triptolemus on the same winged, snake-drawn chariot that I saw during my visit to the Archaeological Museum of Eleusis. No different from the Triptolemus pictured on the British Museum Skifos from Capua, Italy. What is he doing here in Spain? Images of Demeter's royal missionary are, of course, common in Greece, and relics of Greek mystery cults in that part of southern Italy known as Magna Graecia, Great Greece, are not unusual at all. Ever since the 8th century BC, the region was the main target of ancient Greek colonization. But Spain? That's another thing altogether. If Kaiopi Papangeli hung this Iberian Triptolemus next to her Greek Triptolemus in Eleusis, no one would believe it came from a world away. How did the vessel end up here, on the secluded shores of the Greek-speaking world? Does it mean the mysteries, or some local interpretation thereof, were really celebrated this far from Eleusis? It's a question most classicists aren't even trained to ask. Aside from Magna Graecia, the ancient Greek frontier settlements are woefully neglected in the traditional curriculum. I never even heard of Emporion, or Mas Castellar de Pontos, until I picked up the hunt for Greek-inspired graveyard beers around the Mediterranean. Why look beyond Greece when you could spend a lifetime reading the overwhelming amount of literature produced during the Golden Age of Athens? Understandably, that's where the focus of education and scholarship lands, but it comes at a terrible cost. For a secret as intractable as Eleusis, we need to think outside the box and explore every nook and cranny of the ancient world. Fortunately, a handful of classicists are at least open to the possibility that southern Italy wasn't the only rich environment for potential initiates of the mysteries. Though she doesn't write about Mas Castellar de Pontos in any detail, Dr. Denise Demetriou at the University of California, San Diego, does describe Emporion as both a, quote, major economic center and a multi-ethnic environment whose very existence stimulated cross-cultural interactions with the indigenous populations. As with other axes of trade and commercial activity across the former Greek-speaking Mediterranean, a peculiar mixture of religious influences in Catalonia was only natural. Far from Athens, it would make the ideal home for experimentation and, just maybe, the revelation of the Kukian psychedelic recipe that the officials in Eleusis tried so hard to protect. According to Demetriou, religion in a cosmopolitan capital like Emporion was, quote, more flexible than back home in Greece, which meant the usual exclusivity of cult wasn't always so strictly enforced. She points to Delphi and Olympia as examples of, quote, open access sanctuaries, where visits by the inexperienced would be facilitated by special liaisons. If Mas Castellar de Pontos was an open access sanctuary, then the mysteries of Eleusis would have been the most logical rites over which the Greeks and the locals would have found common ground. According to classicist François de Polignac, underworld cults like Demeter's, with her agrarian or even funerary connotations, had a universal quality. Like the prehistoric skull cult from Anatolia, the mysteries promised a temporary return to a more primitive life and a period before the establishment of the city. For their part, the mother-daughter duo of Demeter and Persephone offered, quote, a familiar face to the locals, who might have known them by another name. In order to initiate the homesick Greeks or the curious Catalonians into the secrets of Eleusis, however, a dedicated sanctuary would have been integral to the ritual experience. As it turns out, that's exactly what Dr. Enriqueta Pons uncovered. By 1997, she had already made excellent progress on the residential area of the Greek farm. A main street cuts down the middle, separating two living quarters on either side. One of the larger units measures almost 250 square feet and is described by Pons as a, quote, domestic chapel for an agrarian cult. Located in a private home, the chamber was managed by women and equipped for domestic activities, but it was also designed to become the scene of initiation rituals, where Demeter or Persephone might appear to the devotees, along with their departed ancestors. The archaeologist calls it a, quote, shared space for the human to come into contact with the divine, or the dead to speak to the living. The methods by which this lost mystery cult would communicate with the underworld can be fairly well reconstructed from the material finds. In the very center of the room, Pons discovered a large rectangular hearth. She uses the Greek word, eschara. The burnt bones of three female dogs were found in a circular clay-coated ditch over 6 feet in diameter. Pieces of an elegantly carved column of Pentelic marble, complete with an Ionic capital, were reassembled to form a 2-foot altar. On top, a rectangular cavity charred by flames showed signs of knife and axe cuttings, evidence of bloody sacrifice. Like the statue of Asclepius in Empúries, the expensive marble was proven by petrographic analysis to have originated at the Mount Pentelicus quarry outside Athens. Interestingly, 10 miniature chalices were scattered all over the chapel and adjoining rooms, and 2 mills were unearthed along with crockery, not only for the grinding and cooking of grain, but also for the brewing of a very special beer. Altogether, Pons interprets the domestic chapel as a holy place where dog sacrifice was combined with ceremonial purifications and ritual drinking. Elsewhere in Bronze Age Iberia, the archaeologist notes that dogs were often buried in graves as part of the grave goods. In ancient Greece, dogs were also associated with the afterlife, where they marked the 3 distinct phases of the immortal journey: the passage from life to death, the time spent in the underworld, and the return to life as a spirit. The most famous hellhound was Cerberus, the 3-headed dog who belonged to Hecate. As the mother of Circe and patron goddess of witchcraft, Hecate had a number of canine epithets: the dog consumer, kunosphages, the dog leader, kunegetes, the dog lover, philoskulax, and the black bitch, kuon melaina. Canine sacrifices in her honor were common in ancient Greece, but Hecate also had a profound relationship to the mysteries. In the hymn to Demeter, Hecate, with her blazing torches, is the only goddess who aids Demeter on the desperate search for her missing daughter, and she alone can accompany Persephone through the land of the dead. Trying to figure out what it all meant, Pons continued her rigorous work on the peculiar domestic chapel for years. She is a native Catalan speaker, so most of her finds are first published in the language that is a source of great pride among the fiercely autonomous Catalonians. The people who gave the world Antoni Gaudí and Salvador Dalí unilaterally declared their independence from Spain in a 2017 referendum that landed a dozen Catalonian political leaders in jail. As their public trial gets underway during my visit, protests and demonstrations are erupting all over Spain. Throughout her career, Pons's unwavering decision to write in Catalan has been a rebellious act that puts her scholarship at serious risk of being ignored by the global academic community, where the lingua franca in classics, history, and archaeology is English, French, or German. Even among the Romance languages, Catalan is only the 6th most spoken, trailing behind Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, and Romanian. In an effort to bring some attention to this Greek colony in the backcountry of Catalonia, Pons finally relented. In 2010, she published a brief article about the dog sacrifice in a French journal, followed in 2016 by a longer treatment in English, which became one chapter in a book organized by the State University of New York. There, the archaeologist details the results of excavations on additional underground silos. In one case, silo 137, quote, numerous drinking vessels were unearthed, suggesting a celebration consisting of a collective banquet. It harkens back to Brian Hayden's feasting model from the last chapter. Ever since the Stone Age, those who drink together stick together. But there's also a spiritual aspect here. Mixed in with the charred barley and animal remains was a spectacular bell-shaped crater or vase featuring a komos, the ritualistic nocturnal procession named after the sun and cupbearer of Dionysus. More appropriate for an Athenian dining room than a subterranean chamber in ancient Catalonia, this crater shows the god of ecstasy as the guest of honor at this drunken parade. Looking back over the past 30 years of Pons's excavations, the intersection of the Eleusinian mysteries and Mas Casillas de Pontos is overpowering. The 2,500 grain silos, the terracotta head and incense burner depicting Demeter, Persephone, the ceramic vessel of their chief missionary, Triptolemus, the drunken symposium on the Dionysian vase, abundant evidence of underworld offerings and dog sacrifice within the domestic chapel and subterranean pits, all closely related to the goddess's sidekick, Hecate. The entire Eleusinian cast of characters is in attendance. Strangely, I didn't know about any of it when I reached out to Pons in November 2018. The only reason I contacted her in the first place was to make sure my Catalan wasn't playing tricks on me. Did she really find archaeobotanical evidence of a psychedelic beer? And why did no one else who was supposed to know such things ever hear about it? Not Zarnkel or McGovern, not Fritz Graf or any of the top-notch classicists I'd been consulting for years, not even Ruck. Unlike her work on the canine ritual, Pons's potential bombshell was never published in any of the mainstream academic journals for English, French, or German speakers. Many months before landing here in Catalonia, I came across her obscure discovery only by accident in the course of my slow, tedious, and often discouraging hunt for hard data on hallucinogenic graveyard beers in the ancient Mediterranean. That research took years in itself and always felt like a blind alley. But I pressed on, because just when I was about to lose hope, the faintest pattern began to emerge. And for some inexplicable reason, all the clues kept leading in the same direction. Spain. There was the intriguing find at Eberdingen-Hochdorf, a Celtic settlement southeast of Stuttgart dating to the 5th and 4th centuries BC. From soil samples, the eminent archaeobotanist Hans-Peter Sticker of the University of Hohenheim identified seeds of the vision-inducing henbane, Hyoscyamus niger, together with germinated hulled barley grains. It suggested a psychedelic brew, especially since the same henbane would later be used in the pre-Reformation hallucinogenic Groot ales in the same region of Germany. But the combination of consumption of the two ingredients, barley and henbane, could not necessarily be proven. Writing in 2010, Sticker ultimately thought a henbane-infused beer was pure speculation. But it's a reasonable avenue of pursuit. Pliny credited the appearance of henbane to Hecate's pet, Cerberus, from whose urine the plant first sprung from the earth. The Greek naturalists referred to the plant as Herba Apollinaris, herb of Apollo, claiming that the Pythia priestesses at Delphi inhaled the smoke of smoldering henbane seeds to produce their oracular visions. Another ancient term for the species, pythonion, cements the connection. So, add henbane to the barley meal and laurel leaves discussed earlier as one more psychedelic candidate for the magic at Delphi. Henbane is a member of the Solanaceae family, which, in addition to the more familiar tomato, potato, and tobacco, also includes mandrake, Mandragora officinarum, deadly nightshade, Atropa belladonna, and black nightshade, Solanum nigrum. The so-called nightshades are among the most poisonous plants in Europe. Starting with Hecate and the Pythia in ancient Greece, they became so synonymous with black magic in the Middle Ages and Renaissance that, even through the 19th century, the nightshades were still easily anthropomorphized as witches and whores. They were also regarded as the key psychedelic ingredients of the witch's flying ointment that we will review in the next part of this investigation. After the henbane lead, I came across three intriguing reports from Spain, all from the early 2000s, and all published in either Spanish or Catalan. First, a ritual pit at Prats in Andorra, the tiny country between France and Spain, turned up archaeochemical evidence of calcium oxalate, or beer stone, in several ceramic pots. In addition, the researchers discovered an unidentifiable species of mushroom wrapped in fern fronds and eight seeds of jimson weed, Datura stramonium. Like its sister nightshades, jimson weed contains a number of visionary and potentially fatal tropane alkaloids, atropine, scopolamine, and hyoscyamine. An intriguing find, but the site did it far too early, 1600 BC, for Greek colonization. The second report pushed the clock back even further. The alkaloid hyoscyamine and traces of barley beer were recovered from the undisturbed burial cave at Calvari d'Amposta in Tarragona, south of Barcelona. The hyoscyamine could have come from any of the sinister nightshades. Dating to 2340 BC, the remains were interpreted as, quote, a hallucinogenic beer that was consumed during the mortuary ceremonies. The third report was the most exciting. As part of a similar barley-based mixture, the same witchy hyoscyamine was again detected in a luxurious tomb at the necropolis of Las Ruedas in north-central Spain, outside Valladolid. Unlike the others, these remains dated to the pre-Roman Celtic population known as the Vaxians from the 2nd century BC. The depth of contact between the Greek coastal colonies in Spain and the local tribe at the Pintia archaeological site so far inland is unknown. But for some reason, the special brew was hiding out in yet another Iberian version of the Eleusinian Kernos. It wasn't the only Kernos recovered from the site, but it was the only one that tested positive for the psychedelic graveyard beer. Just like the Empúries Kernos unearthed in 2008, the vessels at Pintia instantly point to the mysteries. Years of searching for an ancient specimen of hallucinogenic beer had finally paid off. When I pinpointed the evidence at the necropolis of Las Ruedas, sporting an explicit Greek connection, I set my sights on Spain. With the archaeobotanical and archaeochemical data from Prats and Tarragona establishing a couple thousand years of extreme brewing in this part of the ancient world, my interest skyrocketed. The excavators of the necropolis of Las Ruedas didn't mince words in the 2003 publication of their organic residue analysis. The psychotropic beer was consumed by, quote, an elite class of warriors during a funeral feast, with the clear intent of propelling an otherworldly journey to the beyond. The team interprets the specific tomb where the psychedelic Kernos was used as the site of an Iberian devotio, a bizarre ritual whereby soldiers took their own lives in a mystical tradition that guaranteed, quote, the divine protection of their chief or general. Western Indo-Europeans with a death cult and psychedelic graveyard beer, contemporaneous with Eleusis. What an amazing confluence of ideas. It's tempting to recognize a Stone Age precedent for the sacrament at the necropolis of Las Ruedas. The trail could stretch, if not all the way back to the Rockefet Cave in Göbekli Tepe, then at least to the unknown botanical experts of prehistoric Anatolia, perhaps the same ones who inspired the Minoan ritual cocktail that Patrick McGovern chemically confirmed at Grave Circle A in Mycenae, or the potion he resurrected from the Phrygian tomb at Gordium, by which the deceased king was, quote, royally ushered into the afterlife with a psychoactive Midas touch. The ancient Greeks weren't the only Indo-Europeans who would have inherited the unique brew, after all. Any of the Indo-European Celts, such as the Vaxians, would have made equally good stewards of the tradition. Interestingly, recent DNA studies have proven that the Catalonians can trace their roots to the arrival of Anatolian Neolithic-associated ancestry, a, quote, pioneer colonization of farmers from the east who settled the peninsula as early as 5,475 BC. Modern Spaniards derive about half of their genetics from these Stone Age agriculturalists. Even more interesting, the oldest archaeobotanical and archaeochemical evidence of beer consumption in all of Europe was discovered in 2006 at the very same place this Anatolian signal appeared in the ancient Iberian DNA, the Neolithic burial cave of Can Sadorní, just southwest of Barcelona. Together with malted grain on a stone hammer and anvil, calcium oxalate was recovered from a jar on site that dated to about 3,470 BC. The beer from Can Sadorní rivals some of the earliest beer finds in ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia, the same period that coincides with the development of the written word around 3200 BC, when history as we know it begins. Did the Iberian beer come with those Anatolian farmers whose DNA is recorded in Western Europe 2 millennia earlier? If so, why wouldn't their craft brew survive another few thousand years? Under Colin Renfrew's Anatolian hypothesis, the Vaxian Celts at the necropolis of Las Ruedas could have inherited not only the language, but also the biotechnology and peculiar religion that the Proto-Indo-Europeans had perfected in their prehistoric homeland of Stone Age Turkey. When Triptolemus showed up on the shores of Catalonia after the founding of the Eleusinian Mysteries, he may have been surprised to learn that his services weren't needed. The locals already knew how to brew beer and spike it with the kind of magical plants that might allow them to accompany their deceased loved ones to the other side, albeit temporarily. Aside from Magna Graecia, if ever there were a captive audience for the mysteries on the European continent, it was in northeastern Spain. All the raw material was already there, like long-lost cousins swapping recipes passed down by a common great ancestor. The Indo-European Greek colonists from Phocaea, who made landfall at Empyrion in the 6th century BC and infiltrated Catalonia for centuries, may have reintroduced the Indo-European Iberians to a very delicate technique. What Ruck calls the secret of secrets, and what Martin Zarnkal refers to as the controlled contamination of a volatile fungal parasite that turns healthy grain into mad grain, Tollkorn in German, to produce an LSD beer, a welcome addition to all the nightshade beers in the region. In the process, the reunited relatives appear to have constructed the Eleusis of the West for any locals who couldn't afford the trip to Athens. In all the relevant studies from the early 2000s, the name of one young archaeobotanist kept popping up, Jordi Juan Treseras from the University of Barcelona. In the summer of 2018, I started reading everything he ever wrote and eventually came across a paper from 2000 in the peer-reviewed Spanish-language journal Complutum. It was a summary of his and other drug-related archaeological findings across Iberia. Stuffed into the middle of the 9-page article was a single paragraph about an apparently unremarkable discovery, quote, the remains of ergot sclerodia at Mas Castellar de Pontos in not one, but two different artifacts connected to Pons's iconic domestic chapel. The fungus was found embedded between several teeth of a human jawbone. Microscopic evidence of the same organism was additionally identified in one of the miniature chalices that once contained a special beer. Given the cultic context of the area where both relics were unearthed in 1997, Juan Treseras linked whatever potion filled the tiny cup to the consumption of the Kukian during the mysteries of Eleusis. After all, ergot played a fundamental role in the ancient Greek rites, according to Gordon Wasson, and no less a scientific expert than Albert Hofmann had explained how the entheogenic alkaloids in ergot, like the water-soluble ergine and ergonovine, could have easily been separated from the toxic alkaloids. In his bibliography, Juan Treseras listed a Spanish version of the Road to Eleusis published in Mexico in 1980 that I didn't even know existed. Given all the leads for psychedelic graveyard beer emerging from ancient Iberia over the past 20 years, I wasn't necessarily surprised, but the scientific identification of ergot was absolutely unique and almost too good to be true. So, I followed the trail of breadcrumbs to the only published material that ever presented the full archaeological background of the Catalonian Kukian, a massive 635-page tome published in 2002 as a complete record of Enriqueta Pons's tenacious work at Pontos from 1990 to 1998. To this day, the monograph has only ever been published in Catalan. I was able to find a copy at the Library of Congress, where I dove into one of Indo-Europeans' most distinctive tongues for days. Next to the altar of Pentelic marble, amid the charred skeletons of sacrificed dogs, Pons's team chanced upon the lower right jawbone of an adult male between the ages of 20 and 25. 4 teeth were intact, 3 were missing. They date it from between 200 and 175 BC. Juan Treseras analyzed 2 samples of tartar for any microscopic vegetal remains. Together with minerals like quartz and basalt, the silica phytoliths, calcium oxalate crystals, starch grains, and microcarbons all indicated a cereal-based diet. But more intriguing for the archaeobotanist was the presence in both samples of ergot, which is sejol banyut in Catalan. How to explain this out-of-place jawbone in a ceremonial chamber that Juan Tresserras calls, quote, a sanctuary dedicated to Demeter and Kore Persephone. That the ergot was ingested seems clear, leading the scientists to only two possible interpretations, accidental or intentional consumption. The former would have occurred in the wake of an infected harvest, just as in the frequent bouts of ergotism or St. Anthony's fire throughout the Middle Ages. The latter would, of course, make sense as part of a ritual associated with entheogenic drinks, like the kukion. Interestingly, Juan Tresserras did not detect any ergot in the two mills where Pons believes the grain was prepared and the beer was brewed. So there doesn't appear to have been an accidental ergot outbreak. The intentional consumption hypothesis gains traction from the very existence of the jawbone in a sacred enclosure where no other human remains were recovered. Whenever a skull shows up, some very ancient religion is at play. Over a couple of dense pages in the Catalan monograph, Juan Tresserras charts the various death cults that have been archaeologically catalogued across the Celtic strongholds of the British Isles, Belgium, France, and Spain, where defleshing of corpses, ritual decapitation, and decorative skulls are all attested. He entertains the possibility that the jawbone from the domestic chapel belonged to, quote, an exceptional person, a, quote, initiate, whose skull had some special significance to the members of the cult. Likewise, Pons believes the jawbone was used in rituals for making contact with dead ancestors. Whatever took place in the sanctuary, she discerns a mix of Greek, Celtic, and indigenous Iberian influences. As a meeting place for distant Indo-European cousins, could Mas Castellar de Pontos be evidence of the same skull cult discovered at Göbekli Tepe? The German Archaeological Institute believes the crania at the world's first temple were deliberately manipulated for ritual display. Dated some 8 to 9,000 years before Pons's excavations in Catalonia, the prehistoric skulls are thought to represent a primitive version of ancestor veneration and, quote, the interaction of the living with the dead, exactly what Pons sees in Iberia. Under Colin Renfrew's Anatolian hypothesis, did elements of the Stone Age religion really survive for thousands of years by means of a missing Proto-Indo-European language, only to wind up on the other side of the European continent? And is the graveyard beer the elusive cipher that finally unlocks the deepest mysteries and real purpose of ancient sites as diverse as Göbekli Tepe, Eleusis, and Mas Castellar de Pontos? It all comes down to that miniature chalice and its special beer. Under the radar of all the professional academics who basically ignore anything published in Catalan, Juan Tresserras was able to dissect an archaeobotanical clue that just may vindicate a scorned hypothesis from 1978 about the original contents of the ancient Greek kukion and the best-kept secret in the history of Western civilization. Martin Zonkow's intuition that prehistoric brewers could have created an ergot-infused beer for special occasions seemed well-supported. Informed speculation, but speculation nonetheless. When I finally read Juan Tresserras' analysis of the ancient contents of the tiny cup unearthed near the jawbone, however, everything changed. On the gilded dome of the main reading room in the Library of Congress, the lantern's female figure, a symbol of human understanding, is depicted lifting the veil of ignorance from her face. I could feel her glaring down at me as the first hard evidence for the hypothesis that tanked Ruck's career hit me right in the chest. At the tail end of his PhD studies, Juan Tresserras had access to one of the most equipped research and development laboratories in Europe at the University of Barcelona. Now called the Science and Technology Centers, Centros Científicos y Tecnológicos, or CCITUB, the facilities spread across four campuses specialize in chemistry, material science, and biosciences. They just celebrated their 30th anniversary in 2018. Using both optical microscopy and a scanning electron microscope, the archaeobotanist unveils the results of his 1997 study in poetic Catalan. Residues associated with a type of beer have been detected in good amounts. Remains of gelatinized starches, starches with signs of enzymatic attack, yeasts, frustules of diatoms, something rather strange in such a small vessel. This find can be interpreted as either an offering of beer sediment or as the residue of a product that was used and/or consumed. Regardless, the element to highlight is the presence of the remains of ergot sclerotia, claviceps, also identified in one of the human jawbones. This purple-colored mushroom has been associated with Demeter as well, especially because the color is associated with the goddess, and also because this fungus undergoes a cycle similar to the myth of Demeter and Persephone. After infecting the grain plant with ascospores, the purple-colored sclerotia that envelop the ears of the mature grain begin forming. At first, the sclerotia fall to the ground where they pass the winter and fruit with the first spring rains, forming little purple-colored mushrooms that release ascospores that, using the wind to intercede, wind up infecting the ears. The harvest of the ears infected with sclerotia and their later processing contaminate the grain with toxic alkaloids. The psychoactive alkaloids of ergot are basically derivatives of lysergic acid and have hallucinogenic effects. I immediately reached out to both Enriqueta Pons and Jordi Juan-Treserras. Both were equally taken aback by my interest in a 20-year-old discovery that had received only passing reference during a bygone moment of their careers. Right where she started in 1990, Pons was still leading the excavations at Mas Casillas de Pontos, and she welcomed my visit to the Benedictine Abbey of Saint-Père de Galigon. I had to see the miniature vessel and other artifacts for myself, but there was really only one person in the world who deserved a blind date with his potential smoking gun. So I called up a crazy old professor at Boston University and asked him to join me on a road trip. I step under the gargoyles to greet the squat, white-haired Pons and the current director of Girona's Archaeological Museum, Ramon Buxó. We communicate in Spanish, though I can hear the Catalan accent behind most syllables. A few minutes later, Ruck approaches the entrance with his longtime collaborator, Mark Hoffman, who has just escorted the 83-year-old classicist from the only parking spot we could find, a good mile from the cramped streets surrounding the medieval monastery. I introduce Ruck to the humble excavator who unearthed the 20-year-old evidence to support a 40-year-old theory in the last place anyone expected to find it. The now-aged scholar and Pons exchange a warm hug. At 6'3", Ruck towers over the archaeologist. The five of us exit the soaring nave of the Romanesque Basilica and head for the rectangular cloister on the right. We ascend into the second story above the sacristy, where the archaeological museum is housed, and set up camp in a windowless conference room. There, on an unassuming desk with a navy tablecloth, waiting for our visit, are the goddesses. The incense burner and the disembodied terracotta head with the upswept hair, both rescued from the underworld grain silos, and both identified as Demeter Persephone. Beside them, a miniature chalice only a couple inches high, with a handle sticking out of either side. The Greeks would call it a kantharos, the ritual cup carried by Dionysus to induce his ecstasy. Pons clutters the table with three decades worth of data on the Greek farm 20 miles to our north. In page after page of carefully prepared color printouts, she walks me, Ruck, and Mark through every conceivable aspect of the site's topography. Schematics, field surveys, aerial photographs. She even slips me a USB drive with drone footage for later viewing. The excavator points out the hundreds of subterranean silos to the west of the residential area on the high plateau. And then she takes us on a virtual tour of the domestic chapel, explaining exactly where the miniature chalice and jawbone were uncovered and where the grain was brewed for the sacrament of beer. She kindly gives me a copy of the 635-page monograph I'll no longer have to storm the Library of Congress to consult. Within a half hour, my brain is about to explode from the nonstop, real-time translation to keep Ruck up to speed. Buxó snaps on a pair of blue latex gloves and delicately places the tiny vessel in the palm of his hand. He offers it for Ruck's inspection the way a sommelier would present the cellar's most expensive vintage. As far as the archaeological fieldwork and scientific analysis conducted thus far is concerned, Ruck is staring at the ancient container for a psychedelic graveyard beer that was brewed in the early 2nd century BC by displaced Greek witches or their pupils. Initiates of the mysteries of Eleusis? Perhaps. magicians, healers, and prophets with a noble Greek pedigree? As we're about to find out, absolutely. Ruck is withdrawn. I want to know what he thinks of the solitary cup he traveled an ocean in 4 decades to see, but I decide to let him process for a few minutes. We stretch our legs and amble into the museum proper to examine the altar of Pentelic marble, quarried outside Athens and shipped all the way here to prepare Hecate's canine victims. To its left, in a display case dedicated to religion, I see the one artifact more than any other that screams the mysteries, Triptolemus. As I study the artifact, I recall Dr. Denise Demetriou's insight that commercial centers like Emporion or Mas Castellar de Pontos could very well have served as open-access sanctuaries, promising a rare glimpse of the Eleusinian secrets in the ancient Greek hinterland. If Demeter's missionary was here, it almost certainly means the Kukion came with him. From the archaeobotanical and archaeochemical data in Prats, Tarragona, and the necropolis of Las Ruedas, the ancient Iberians seem to have preferred the hallucinogenic nightshades to commune with the Lady of the Grain and their departed ancestors. In that case, was a Greek hand to blame for the presence of ergot in that tiny Greek vessel unearthed on the Greek farm? Did Pons and Juan Treserras stumble upon hard evidence of the elusive ingredient that the initiates of the mysteries were forbidden from talking about under penalty of death for close to 2 millennia? In the absence of any analysis of the many vessels recovered from Eleusis itself, is this how history's longest game of hide-and-seek comes to a close? I turn to the crazy old professor and usher him back into the windowless conference room for some alone time with the miniature chalice. We've all peppered Pons with questions over the past hour, so Ruck's reaction is long overdue. I hand him my copy of The Road to Eleusis and dive in. Okay, professor, what do you make of all this? The gears have been spinning in Ruck's head since the moment we set foot inside the dank monastery. His answer came out in a long, run-on sentence, as if it were 1978, and the still-respected professor were back at his home office in Hull, Massachusetts, typing up a finishing thought for the prize manuscript that would rewrite history. "Well, the most important part is where it was found," begins Ruck in that New England baritone, peering down into the chalice. "It was a sacred place for ritual. The shape of the vessel is only used for the shape of the cup drunk by the god Dionysus himself. And considering where they were found," he refers to the other chalices scattered around the domestic chapel, "they're not toys. They're drinking vessels. And the minuscule size of the vessels would indicate that what was drunk was a very powerful potion of some kind. The size makes it clear. A tablespoon was all you needed. This was not a dinner party of wine and hors d'oeuvres. And considering the fact that residue of ergot was found, it would seem to substantiate the idea that some kind of visionary ceremony for the grain goddess or Persephone was being celebrated in a household shrine. If all this shakes out, how do we face the fact that some Greek colonists in an important cult center of the ancient world, contemporaneous with the classical mysteries, were using drugs to find God? We should have no trouble with that," Ruck responds. "It's time that we acknowledge our heritage." And that was it. No malice or hard feelings, just a slight tweak to the theory that Walter Burkert proposed a year before The Road to Eleusis scandalized the most senior discipline in the academy. The same theory echoed by Fritz Graf and Kaiopi Papangeli in recent months as a drug-free Eleusis. In 1977, when Burkert speculated about prehistoric drug rituals at the basis of the mysteries, he wasn't stepping out on a limb. If the Neolithic Revolution really was the beer revolution, then humanity's oldest biotechnology could have existed almost 10,000 years before the Greek mysteries. Exactly when, we still don't know, but the initial findings from the Rockefeller Cave and Göbekli Tepe keep pushing the dates closer and closer to the last ice age. It's the kind of antiquity that was unthinkable to Burkert's generation. Even without the benefit of today's archaeobotany and archaeochemistry, however, the esteemed German was still willing to attribute advanced botanical expertise to the archaic ancestors of the Greeks, whoever they turned out to be, and whenever their creative recipes transformed ordinary brewing into a psychedelic event. By definition, the spread of agriculture had to involve a profound relationship with the natural world. but familiarity with the flora that alter human consciousness was all but assured much earlier in the protracted history of our species, which is at least 300,000 years old and counting. This is not necessarily surprising, says archaeologist Scott M. Fitzpatrick, given that we have been hunters and gatherers for 99% of human history and would have come into contact with, consumed, and experimented with a wide array of plants. But we weren't the first on the scene. We now know for a fact that mastery over the Paleolithic pharmacopoeia transcended even our species. Our closest extinct relatives, the Neanderthals, lived from about 430,000 to 40,000 years ago. In 2012, the teeth of five such individuals, discovered at El Cidrón Cave in northwest Spain, were subjected to sequential thermal desorption gas chromatography mass spectrometry and pyrolysis gas chromatography mass spectrometry. The teeth provided molecular data for cooking and smoke inhalation over a wood-burning fire, as well as, quote, the first evidence for the use of medicinal plants by a Neanderthal. The chemical signatures of yarrow and chamomile were dated to a stunning 50,000 years ago. This new dental calculus evidence tends to support earlier suppositions about the use of medicinal, or at least hygienic, if not spiritually motivated, psychoactive plants by Neanderthals well back into the Pleistocene, 2.58 million years ago to 9,700 BC. It is extremely likely that, as practicing naturalists and early-day ecologists, the Neanderthals must have known and appreciated all of their environment, since their very existence depended on it, and as such, positive and negative experiences with various plants would have been passed down as part of Neanderthal ecological knowledge. According to Burkert, the expertise transferred for tens of thousands of years from Neanderthal to Neanderthal, and Stone Age Homo sapiens to Stone Age Homo sapiens somehow came to a dead stop at the Temple of Demeter. Without ever explaining how, the German scholar suggested that by the time these primitive rites arrived in Eleusis, the drugs had somehow vanished from the festival of immortality that seemed to guarantee some psychedelic beyond, that expansion of consciousness, a decadent escape from reality, was simply an embarrassing episode from the pre-Hellenic past. As John Silber would tell Ruck in 1978, the Greeks just wouldn't have done that sort of thing. The hard data of hallucinogenic beer at Mas Casillar de Pontos says otherwise. Rather than being replaced by one of Burkert's harmless substances, the original Stone Age sacrament seems to have survived well into the historical period within certain Indo-European traditions. Not just the Eastern branch, among the exotic Indians with their psychedelic soma, not just the Western branch, among the bloodthirsty, vaccine Celts with their graveyard beer at the necropolis of Las Ruedas, but among bona fide Greeks who hailed from Phocaea as the Vikings of antiquity with a well-defined lineage. Some scholars may come along and object that the ergot-infused beer at Pons's Greek farm has nothing to do with Greece. Like Prats, Tarragona, and the necropolis of Las Ruedas, it's just another example of Celtic and Iberian extravagance, hardly emblematic of the architects of Western civilization. The Greeks had gotten mixed up with the wrong crowd. But on top of the archaeological finds that show Mas Casillar de Pontos to be immersed in an undeniably Greek context, it would be wise to recall the spiritual sophistication of the colonists who founded Emporion in the first place. They were far from merchants or traders in the ordinary sense. The Phocaeans embossed Persephone on their coins for a reason. They spent many centuries seeding Catalonia with very Greek ideas about her underworld and, much more important, how to access it. But Spain wasn't their only offshore venture. At the beginning of this chapter, Massalia was flagged as the Phocaeans' first colony around 600 BC. Emporion soon followed around 575 BC. Before their home on the Anatolian coast was taken over by the invading Persians, Herodotus says the Phocaeans packed up all the votive offerings from their temples and set sail. Their final headquarters would eventually take root in the heart of Magna Graecia, the now-defunct settlement of Velia, Italy, dates to 530 BC. There, the Phocaeans would give birth to a philosopher, but not just any philosopher. He was a magician, a healer, a prophet, According to the scholar Peter Kingsley, one of the few classicists worth reading aside from Ruck, the Greek genius known as Parmenides was among the first generation of children brought up by Phocaean parents in Velia, with the memories of Phocaea and the journey from Phocaea still running fresh in their blood. Why does that matter? Because the region known as Ionia, where Phocaea was located, left an indelible mark on the modern world. What astrophysicist Carl Sagan once described as the glorious awakening into the laws of nature that happened between 600 and 400 BC in the remote islands and inlets of the eastern Mediterranean. Thales, Anaximander, Theodorus of Samos, the earliest pioneers of science were all the children of merchants. The enduring legacy of the Ionians are the tools and techniques they developed, said Sagan, which remain the basis of modern technology. But the legacy of the so-called pre-Socratics didn't stop there. Perhaps no single individual has done more for Greek branding over the past 2,500 years than Parmenides. Plato claimed the wizard from Velia as his personal guru. For Kingsley, there's no such thing as hyperbole when it comes to Parmenides. And there's no coming to grips with the history of philosophy or wisdom in the West without understanding him. He lies at the central nerve of our culture. Touch him, and indirectly, you're in touch with everything else. He's said to have created the idea of metaphysics. It's said that he invented logic, the basis of our reasoning, the foundation of every single discipline that has come into existence in the West. His influence on Plato was immense. There's a well-known saying that the whole history of Western philosophy is just a series of footnotes to Plato. With the same justification, Plato's philosophy in its developed form could be called a series of footnotes to that man. Without Parmenides, there is no Socrates, Plato, or Aristotle. But like the first scientists from Ionia and the founders of Empyrean, the man born to Phocaean parents in southern Italy didn't come from Athens. That's simply not how Greece came to inflame the imagination of Western civilization. Maybe that's what Ruck means when he says it's high time to, quote, acknowledge our heritage. The same people who invented science also invented techniques for entering the underworld and communing with the immortals, whether gods, goddesses, or ancestors. Techniques, that is, for becoming immortals themselves. The great religions of antiquity all converged in Ionia, where the Phocaeans were the beneficiaries of humanity's collective wisdom. They sat right on the end of the so-called royal road that led through Anatolia and Syria into the Persian Gulf, the caravan route that Kingsley calls a key point in the contact between ancient East and West. The Phocaeans were on the doorstep of history. They absorbed ideas from both of the proposed Indo-European homelands, the scions of the Neolithic agriculturalists, as well as the nomadic Central Asian shamans. They had regular contact with the high cultures of Egypt, Babylonia, Persia, and India. In the roiling Ionian marketplace of ideas, the Phocaeans seem to have perfected one essential trick for cheating the afterlife, a trick they tried to carry to the rest of the world, breaching the Strait of Gibraltar, according to legend. It was colonists from Phocaea, writes Kingsley, who sailed down the west coast of Africa and then up to France and England to Scotland and beyond. But as far as we know, only three Mediterranean colonies were lucky enough to receive the trick: Massalia, Empyrean, and Velia. At the conclusion of this investigation, we will return to the Velians. In a strange twist to an already strange story, the Phocaean community in Magna Graecia survived intact for hundreds of years after Parmenides. When the earliest Christians began celebrating their Eucharist up the coast in Rome, the Velians would insinuate themselves into the very foundations of the latest mystery religion, where the precious secret of how to die before you die was practiced by the first generations of Christians, the so-called Paleo-Christians, and later suppressed by the growing bureaucracy of a faith that chose to deny its Greek heritage. Ruck knows that, of course. Raised Catholic, he's been researching the origins of Christianity his entire career and writing about it since the early 2000s. The evidence at Empyrean doesn't just implicate the ancient Greeks. It implicates their Phocaean sister city in Velia. And, by a documented line of succession that we will explore, it implicates Rome. For the devotees of Jesus and the Catholic Church especially, the notion that their religion was midwifed by Greek-speaking Italian mystics with a spiked Eucharist could prove a very hard pill to swallow. But Ruck has been down this road before. So, even if it takes a little while for the evidence to come to light, the old professor is confident that a new generation of archaeochemists will be able to scientifically confirm the true nature of the original Eucharist in the years to come, and in the process, explain why the Paleo-Christians in southern Italy and other Greek-speaking pockets of the ancient Mediterranean would have embraced the religion of Jesus, not as something unfamiliar or unique, but a convenient take on the same mysteries that had coaxed their Greek ancestors to Eleusis for 2,000 years, and the same mysteries that had inspired their Greek cousins at Mas Casejar de Pontos to create their very own house temple with their very own home brew. More than 200 years before Jesus and his Last Supper brought the mysteries into the dining room, the Greeks in Iberia beat him to the punch. They and their fellow witches in southern Italy were paving the way for the world's biggest religion to find easy converts in every kitchen across the Roman Empire. In 1978, a lone classicist at Boston University tried to tell the world about this whole perverse idea, but the world wasn't quite ready. Before we leave the Benedictine Abbey of Saint-Père de Galigon, I have to ask Ruck one final question. Do you think this vindicates the past 40 years of your tortured life? He grinned. Well, it will certainly make some people unhappy, won't it? Epilogue to Part 1. No lawyer ends his 12-year hunt for evidence without calling in the expert witnesses. In May 2020, when this book had already been written and we found ourselves in the midst of a global experiment in social distancing, I called up the Godfather. Aside from being one of the smartest human beings I've ever known, Greg Nagy is also one of the kindest. Ordinarily, I would just drop by the world's leading institution for the study of ancient Greece right here in Washington, D.C. But COVID-19 had us in uncharted waters. So there would be no 20-minute drive down Massachusetts Avenue, past the Vatican Embassy and the Clintons' neo-Georgian mansion on Whitehaven Street, to see Harvard University's most esteemed professor of classical Greek literature. Since 2000, Nagy has been the director of the Center for Hellenic Studies, which sits on a spectacular plot of land that was donated to Harvard by the Mellon family in 1961. And since we first met in 2015, whenever he wasn't teaching up in Boston, Nagy would be there to answer rambling questions from a one-time aspiring classicist, breathlessly knocking on the door with each new discovery. When I approached the legendary professor with my idea of putting Ruck's absurd hypothesis to the 21st century test, Nagy was immediately receptive. It was news to me, but he and the Harvard-educated Ruck were actually dear friends back in the day. Nagy's wife was even once a student of Ruck. Boston was a smaller world in the 1970s and 80s. In the wake of the Road to Eleusis, however, the two classicists parted ways and lost touch. Nagy would soar to the very height of the profession. Ruck, for his original sin, would drift into obscurity. As a card-carrying Indo-Europeanist, Nagy had always been sympathetic to Wasson's work on Soma, and from the start, he had little problem, at least conceptually, with a similar sacrament at work among the ancient Greeks. Open-minded though he was, Nagy had no tolerance for bad scholarship. So, to aid the investigation, he generously gave me access to the 65,000-volume private library at the Center for Hellenic Studies. And he arranged for me to obtain borrowing privileges from Harvard's equally exclusive mini-campus at Dumbarton Oaks in Georgetown. After years of following my progress, the call with Nagy was a long time in the making. I'd already sent him all the updates from Spain, including the archaeobotanical data on the 2,200-year-old ergotized bier. The Hellenic presence at Mas Castellar de Pontos was self-evident. And to my relief, Enriqueta Ponce's meticulous fieldwork allowed for an interdisciplinary reading of those Greco-Iberian mysteries as a curious echo of the Eleusinian mysteries that Nagy found generally convincing. But the tougher question was whether Jordi Juan Treserras had gotten the science right. For that, Nagy preferred another witness take the stand. So I made a quarantine date with Patrick McGovern, who was sheltering in place up in Philadelphia. I needed the opinion of the archaeochemist whose recreation of the Minoan ritual cocktail and Midas touch made this whole pursuit for the original Kukian seem like not a complete waste of my adult life. He knew many of the specifics already. When I first alerted him to Jordi's analysis in April 2019, McGovern was keen to review a, quote, detailed archaeobotanical report and the original photomicrographs that Jordi had taken of the ergot under optical microscopy and scanning electron microscope over 20 years ago. The road to archaeochemical glory is littered with the carcasses of false positives and misinterpretations, McGovern reminded me, and I needed to proceed cautiously. As just one example among many, consider the lack of consensus on Shakespeare's drug habit. In 2015, when the chemical signature of cannabis was reported on pipe fragments excavated from the garden of the most celebrated writer in the English language, the headlines went all in. Was William Shakespeare high when he penned his plays? Most media ignored the fact that the original identification of cannabinoids by gas chromatography mass spectrometry dated back to 2001 and was merely suggestive of cannabis. The more definitive results, which largely went unannounced, were nicotine, cocaine, and myristic acid, likely derived from nutmeg, which is psychedelic in high doses, supporting the view that, quote, at least one hallucinogen was accessible to Shakespeare in the 17th century. Short of exhuming the Bard of Avon's body, however, proving he actually smoked the spiked tobacco is pretty hard to do with 100% confidence. For the next year, I professionally harassed Jordi to scour his physical archives and computer for every scrap of paper and kilobyte of data that had anything to do with the ergotized beer at Mas Castellar de Pontos. In the mid-2000s, Jordi left archaeochemistry for a career in cultural heritage management, so asking him to drop everything for a stubborn American took some major arm-twisting. But to his credit, on the infrequent visits to the beach house that held Jordi's scientific records, he would rip into that mountain of dusty boxes, hoping to turn up something of value. In the meantime, I reached out to Jordi's old mentor, the respected archaeologist Dr. Josep Maria Fulola, as well as the staff at the University of Barcelona's Science and Technology Centers, where the original analysis was performed. Fulola sent me a hard copy of Jordi's unpublished thesis from 1997, in which the young archaeochemist included a breakdown of the two samples taken from the jawbone of the initiate. The presence of ergot is clearly documented in the domestic chapel where the mysteries are believed to have taken place. But it wasn't enough. So, as 2019 gave way to 2020, I begged Jordi to do one last search for McGovern's detailed archaeobotanical report over the holidays. A couple weeks later, eureka! After more than two decades in a buried stack of notes, Jordi sent me his full analysis of both the jawbone and the miniature chalice, including a nice description of his methodology, instrumentation, and results. Once again, the presence of ergot is clearly documented, not only in the vessel itself, like Shakespeare's pipe, but in the human skull. It all points to some kind of hallucinogenic beer being not only prepared, but consumed. What neither Jordi nor the University of Barcelona could find were those photomicrographs, images of the microscopic ergot that would allow us to see what he saw and to confirm the hit. Then again, how could the mysteries end without a mystery? On the quarantine call, McGovern said the absence of those original pictures adds an element of uncertainty to Jordi's identification of ergot. McGovern has written elsewhere that a botanist or chemist by definition will always demand ever more definitive proof. But he also acknowledged that despite technological advances, archaeochemistry remains a discipline still very much, quote, trying to find its feet. And to this day, it is not entirely unusual for samples and data to go missing, including at the University of Pennsylvania and the most accredited institutions in Europe. It was also comforting to hear that McGovern takes no issue with Jordi's bona fides. From the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, the Spanish archaeochemist was prolific. He contributed to dozens of scholarly and peer-reviewed publications, including a few that mentioned the graveyard beer from Mas Casteller de Pontos in passing. Jordi was a known entity. As McGovern himself records in his book, Uncorking the Past, the two of them even enjoyed a few drinks together at the first International Congress on Beer in Prehistory and Antiquity, which took place in Barcelona in 2004. Aside from bad scholarship, if there's one thing Greg Nagy has no tolerance for, it's sloppy language. So, in deference to Harvard's classicist par excellence, I want to be exacting but fair. The archaeobotanical find in Catalonia doesn't automatically mean that Plato and the millions of initiates trekked to Eleusis for 2,000 years to drink beer laced with ergot. But given all the material recovered from Mas Casteller de Pontos and its environs over the past 30 years by a dedicated and responsible archaeologist in Enriqueta Pons, I do see underworld cult activity that reeks of the Greek mysteries. And given the intrepid work by Jordi Juan Treserras of good repute, I have no reason to doubt his data. I don't think he's lying, and I don't think someone of his caliber mistook the ergot for something else. With complete confidence, can we say the Greek farm was founded by magicians, healers, and prophets as the Eleusis of the West, with the stated goal of drinking hallucinogenic beer on a regular basis? Not any